so hard to take that because there's a way it touches us too, because we're kind of that group, right? That they're angry with, and yet we need to be that. And it changes us when we really sit in it. It's really uncomfortable. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying, you know, if it's like intense, like anger and rage coming at you, like there's limits of what we can handle. But sometimes it is anger. Sometimes it is rage in the room, not at you, but in the room that touches you, and it hurts, and it's painful, and yet it can be very transformative.
So as we're wrapping up our
Yeah.
show, could you just summarize really in a sentence or
Sure.
two, you know, the heart of your work and what you'd hope the listeners take from this show?
I think the biggest piece is it's so much around capacity of us just being able to tolerate being with each other's suffering, right? To really be in our hearts and to really just experience together being with the suffering of others, not to erase it, not to get rid of it, not to even totally join it, but just almost like we're witnessing and we're being with each other's suffering.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and just sharing a little about who you are and what you're doing in the world. I think it has immense value for the growth of our society and our cultures. So thank you so
Thank
much.
you. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Take good care.
All right.
There you have it, folks. Angela Okawa, which I believe you can find at mindfuldiversity.com. Check her out and her work out as well. And I really appreciate you all listening today. Remember, we're kind of closing our show in a few weeks. So thank you all so much for listening this whole time. And just a reminder, this is your life to live. So dare to dream and live big and become who you're meant to be. From Radio Boise, this is Radio Awaken. I'm Dr. Mike Shapiro.
Good morning. You have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s, standing on your head. Yow!
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kboo.org to learn more. That's program@kboo.org.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. As we hit the end of the year, I'll be returning to some past guests on the food show. Later in the hour, I'll be playing a story told by fermentation enthusiast Sander Katz about a trip he took to Indonesia where he witnessed tempeh being made the traditional way. But first, I recently checked back in with Liz Carlisle, author of the book Lentil Underground. You can find my interview with Liz from a couple years back on the KBOO website. In our recent conversation, Liz and I were joined by Tavia Gilbert, who is, among other things, an award-winning audiobook narrator. Tavia talked about her relationship with the book and read a passage. Here is that conversation.
I'm Liz Carlisle. I'm the author of Lentil Underground, and I teach in the School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences at Stanford University.
My name is Tavia Gilbert, and I am the narrator of The Lentil Underground. I work primarily as an audiobook narrator, but I'm also a publisher, producer, writer, visual artist, and a number of other things. And really happy to be here.
Listeners can go back to the archive and hear our interview when Lentil Underground first came out, but could you give us a quick overview of the book?
Yeah, so this is the story of the sustainable agriculture movement in my home state of Montana, and kind of a microcosm of, I think, this challenge that we're facing in our food system in this country to try to move towards more environmental sustainability, as well as, you know, save many family farms that are really on the brink of bankruptcy and boost rural economic development at the same time as we're trying to solve these health problems and these environmental problems in our food system.
In your research and writing, what did you find most illuminating, or what did you kind of come across that was the most interesting?
I think what was really interesting to me about this story is I was researching this book in rural Montana and rural eastern Montana, which is the state I grew up in, but it's not the part of the state I grew up in. I grew up in a college town, Missoula, on the western half of the state. And I think I had always thought about food system activism as really sort of originating from consumers who were concerned about the carbon footprint of their diet and the health of their diet. And I was really amazed by the extent to which farmers themselves, even farmers who were working within limited incomes and really difficult circumstances, were working really hard to make our food system more sustainable and had been doing so for decades, that there were these organized networks of farmers who were working with each other to try to figure out, how do we get off synthetic fertilizer? How do we stop using pesticide? Can we grow healthy food for consumers and also improve our bottom line so that we can pass this land on to our kids? So that's why I was really passionate about writing this book, is so that people could understand that, wow, you know, farmers are working on these problems and we should all really support them.
And Tavia, before we talk about the process of making an audiobook version of Lentil Underground, what was your response to reading the book?
You know, the people who cast me for books know me very well, and they know what my heart and soul respond to. So when I was offered this book, I was very moved by the idea of it. When I was a young acting student, I created for my senior thesis project an original drama, a nonfiction fiction about the effects of corporate farming on family farms. And I did about 3 years of research into genetically modified foods and family farms in America, how they've changed over the years, how they've been impacted by corporate farming. So I was absolutely delighted to be offered this book because it was a subject that is so close to my heart. Almost 20, you know, not quite 20 years after graduation from college, it's still a subject that I follow closely and think it gets to the very heart of the American dream, the American ideal of self-determination and self-reliance, and really food security is democracy. So I was riveted by the subject matter and totally invested in the book in a very emotional, very personal way.
So it's been about 2.5 years since the book came out. Has anything been added or changed since the initial writing of the book?
You know, it's been remarkably consistent from hardcover to paperback. Certainly lots of things were worked on in the drafting process at the end. We tried really hard to get the hardcover right. But, you know, the audiobook is a whole different kettle of fish.
Well, and can you explain, how is the audiobook different?
The work of an audiobook narrator is to be a medium for the writer, to translate into an audio performance what the writer put on the page. Both mediums, print and audio, are very intimate, of course, and nothing can replace the printed word, nor should it. But an audio experience of a story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is a deeply intimate exercise. The storyteller is talking directly into the listener's ear. It's I just ran into an audiobook narrator who I adore and told her Friday, every time I hear her voice, it's like imprinting, like those, I think geese imprint that's the feeling. There's a relationship that's created between the storyteller and the listener. So taking a piece of nonfiction, which is just as passionate, just as emotionally evocative as a piece of fiction, and performing it offers just one more opportunity to reach an audience in a very intimate way. And I love that this was put into audio, because this is not just about, it's not just a nonfiction story about lentils. It's human beings being self-determined, self-actualized, combining forces to be mutually independent and interdependent. So it's a really passionate story that I think is perfectly suited to the audio art form.
Well, I want to kind of get to the heart of what you're kind of accomplishing with this book. You talk about the people that are involved. This is a very stories-focused book. And I want to kind of ask you why. So when it comes to complex social and environmental issues, like the challenges that face our food system, why write about the stories of particular people?
Well, I think that everybody, you know, my readers, are people who live at the scale of a human life. We all experience the drama of our own lives, of trying to make meaning in our lives, of figuring out what it is we want to do in the short time we're on this planet. And when I talk to people about those kinds of deep questions, it seems like many people have kind of similar themes that emerge. We want to leave things better for our communities, for the world. We want to pass something better on to our children. We want to have some kind of a positive impact on the people around us. And I feel like that was really what was at the center of the story of these farmers, particularly David Oyen in central Montana, who were trying to move to an organic food system. That it was really about trying to leave the world better for the next generation, trying to contribute something to their community and really make meaning out of their lives on this planet and understand our place as humans, really understand the human condition. So I wanted to write about it in that way, because sometimes I think complex issues like the food system, like the environmental issues we face, can feel really abstract, or they can feel kind of beyond our reach. And I think the story and the people's lives who are involved in trying to accomplish these things really bring it home in a way that people can relate to, whether it's to sort of understand that they're on an analogous journey or maybe they're on a similar journey. There's something there that, as Tevia was saying, is very intimate and very passionate, and that's really what I wanted to share.
I'm also wondering, you know, as somebody who's lived on one of the coasts for a number of years, to be able to like understand what's going on in the middle of the country, it helps to have a person that we can look to see their experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I hope that this book is sort of a cross-cultural vehicle for people in farm country and people on the coast, or maybe people around the world. The book was translated into Japanese, and I've gotten emails from people in other places, too, to try to understand each other in these human terms and understand the things that we do have in common, and that really people, of course, do want to move towards this shared prosperity for our future, even though, you know, of course, we hear all these news stories about, you know, the debates that we're in and the conflict that we're in and the political divides that we have. There is this common desire to leave the world better for our children. And I think that if we can have more dialogue based on that, that we can make more progress in really getting there.
So I've had the good fortune to meet and work with Tevia and witness her bring a piece of text to life. And so, Liz, I'm just curious, what is it that Tevia brings to enhance Lentil Underground?
Oh gosh, it's just amazing. I mean, so she's the best in the business. She probably won't tell you this herself, but she won the award this year, 2017, the Audi Award for the best female narrator of audiobooks. And what she brings is this understanding of how to perform a story. When I first heard clips of her reading Lentil Underground, I felt like I'd gone to Lentil Underground, the Broadway production, and I was hearing the soundtrack of that. And, you know, as a person who loves that art form as well, who loves theater, film, I understand what's different about that than reading a book. I mean, they're both wonderful, potentially transformative experiences, but they're different. And I've always had this dream that somebody might be able to actually drive across Montana while listening to this story. And so I think she's made that come true for me as well. That obviously when people listen to audio, they can be in a number of different settings, and that can be really powerful as well. And it's just, it's a whole new audience that this story can access. There are now lots of people who listen to audiobooks rather than read, or who do it in addition to reading. And I just think it's wonderful to transfer into this new medium because of this wonderful actress who took this on. So it's been fun for me. I feel like I've seen the story in a whole new light, too.
You're listening to The Food Show. I'm Chris Siegel. I'm talking with Liz Carlisle and Tavia Gilbert, who have recently released the audiobook for Lintel Underground. I asked Tavia to read a passage from the book for us. Liz sets it up.
This is the passage in the book that talks about what this story means in human terms, and really why community and this recognition of interdependence is at the center of not only fixing our food system, but I think addressing all these really critical environmental challenges and social challenges that are top of mind for a lot of people right now, I think, at this moment in human history.
Great. I'll read it's a fairly short section. Just about a page long. And the section is headed, "You Can't Do It Alone," which is a great way to set off what the thrust of the book is. Much like a newly initiated legume farmer, I want to think that lentils are a straightforward substitute for synthetic fertilizer, a cheaper, more environmentally benign alternative. To some extent, this is true. But if that was really all there was to it, there would be no Lintel Underground, just a smattering of savvy growers rationally applying plant-based nitrogen instead of expensive ammonium nitrate. But the fact is that biological fertility is more than just a different nutrient management approach. It's an entirely different way of life, one in which time and space broaden considerably, and the illusion of control falls apart. Building your soil biologically is not a precise prescription for a particular crop, but a contribution to a larger ecology, subject to independent variables, geologic time, and global biogeochemical cycles. You will not capture all the value on this farm in this year. You cannot individualize your return. To build biological fertility is to build community, to accept interdependence with other creatures and foster a common benefit. This way of life cultivates a new kind of awareness, a new empathy. You have to pay attention beyond this homestead. You have to pay attention beyond this season. You cannot spray and then forget about it and go to the lake. Planting organic lentils and all the other crops that go with them becomes part of who you are, what you are conscious of, how you see the world. It forces you to listen more deeply, more expansively, and it softens, to some extent, the borders of the self. This is the great irony of the Lintel Underground, or perhaps its secret. What rugged individualism brought together, only community can sustain. I love that section. That's such a great, like the perfect section to pull from the book, because it really is this beautiful piece of writing about how it's not just what we're putting in the earth or our yields or the ratio of fertilizer to growing days. It is about community. It is about being responsive to one's home, which is the earth on which we live, the families in which we farm, the communities in which we partner. It's really such a beautiful analogy for, I think, a way of life that is not dying, but is really fighting to be sustained and acknowledged. It's not all black and white data. We are living creatures in relationship with one another and with our planet. So I love this book.
Well, and as somebody who's read the book, it is exciting to hear it kind of embodied in the way that you read it. And I know for our listeners and myself, we're hearing it via the phone, but I can only imagine how kind of powerful those words are made by, you know, your reading.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just transported listening to her perform that section. I just closed my eyes and experienced it. And I think it's amazing because I feel like she is bringing forth what is at the heart of these people's stories who I spoke to. It's like, it's almost like she knew them, just totally got it. And I think it's really powerful. I think about moments I've had at musical concerts because it feels very much like music when Tavia reads, and that feeling of just being transported by something that you can feel that inspires you to be some really important part of who you are as a human in some really fundamental way. So, yeah, I mean, what a great experience for me. I love it.
Those are really kind words. And one of the things that was so cool about being cast for this is that I do know these places. So I grew up in southern Idaho. My childhood was full of the landscape of Idaho and Wyoming and Montana. And so when Liz is writing about these places, these are places I know. I spent a lot of time in Bozeman and Missoula, and it's meaningful to, I can always dive into any book that I'm narrating and make it personal, but when it already is personal, it's like I get to luxuriate in that story even more than I would otherwise.
What do you think is something new that someone who has read the book would glean from the experience of listening to it?
I think there's a sense with nonfiction often that nonfiction is dry. And when you have a writer like Liz, it's obviously a passionate book. But I do think that people have a certain preconceived idea of the emotional nature of a book of nonfiction. And I think that I am very emotionally available to my reads, and that's the great narrators are always emotionally available and emotionally evocative in their read. But I think that might be a new layer a listener might have even more present in their experience with the book, that the passion driving Liz to devote herself to this study and research and relationship building for years, the relationship and passion of the farmers, I think that really comes through in an audio performance.
My experience of it, in addition to that, is that you can visualize more freely. When I'm listening to Tavia read, my vision and my visual imagination doesn't have to focus on words on a page, and it's totally available for me to then visualize everything that she's reading to me. And I found that quite powerful. It's more cinematic.
We're about out of time, but I'm curious, how can people find the audiobook version of Lintel Underground?
It's a Cantor audiobook. So if you were to Google, honestly, if you were to Google Lintel Underground audiobook, you would find it. But you would find it on the Cantor audiobook webpage.
And you can also go to audible.com, which has that available for download. Or I believe it would be available at any of the streaming services, downpour.com, audiobooks.com, and through the library streaming services like Overdrive or OneClick. Those are also great places to find audiobooks.
Great. Liz, thank you for coming back on the show. And Tavia, thank you so much for joining us and for a wonderful performance. It was a privilege to get to hear that read.
Oh, it's so great to be here with you. Thanks for having me. Liz, thank you so much for this book. Really, it was such a delight to get to do.
Well, really, my pleasure and my honor. Thank you, of course, so much, Tavia, for reading and performing this book. And Chris, thanks so much for the conversation.
That was Liz Carlisle and Tavia Gilbert talking about the audiobook of Lintel Underground. Up next, I'm going to play a story from the Food Show Archives. A few years back, I had the opportunity to interview Sandor Katz before the annual Fermentation Festival. He told me a story about a trip he took to Indonesia. He witnessed tempeh being made in a regional process, and it got him thinking about the difference between industrial and traditional food production. Here's that story from Sandor Katz.
So tempeh is a style of fermenting soybeans where you basically use molds that digest the soybeans and also bind them together into a mat that's typically sliced up and fried, and it comes from the Indonesian island of Java.
Hello?
Tempeh has been available in the United States since the 70s. It's really easy to trace exactly how tempeh became popular in the U.S. And it was subcultures, and specifically from a community in Tennessee called The Farm, which was sort of trying to have a basically soy-based vegan diet, but they recognized that they couldn't just eat soybeans even though they were so protein rich, so they started investigating different traditional ways of preparing soybeans, they learned about tempeh from food scientists at Cornell, as I understand it, and they obtained a sample of a starter for tempeh that was a pure culture starter of a mold called Rhizopus oligosporus that actually. The USDA maintains a culture collection, and they basically obtained a sample of the strain of Rhizopus oligosporus that's in the USDA's culture collection, and it's called Var Saito. And Saito is a Japanese microbiologist who, I guess, is the first microbiologist who really investigated tempeh and, out of the tempeh sort of picked that particular strain out as the sort of active principle of the tempeh. And in microbiology, this has really been, the approach to fermentation is sort of, look at these, undefined groups of organisms that are found on different traditional foods and really pick out the essential organisms out of that to get rid of everything that's extraneous, because the bias in microbiology is that in general microorganisms are dangerous, and we should just figure out what the specifically functional ones are and get rid of all the other ones. So in a laboratory under sterile conditions, it's pretty easy to propagate a pure strain fungus. But in a home kitchen, it's extremely challenging, and I would say it's the most challenging thing that I've ever done in the realm of fermentation, is trying to propagate pure culture Rhizopus oligosporus. And I've done it a few times, but with limited success. But I was amazed when I went to Indonesia and visited a village where they produce tempeh, to see what the source of the culture was. And it basically, this guy pulled down a shoebox filled with these moldy leaves of a particular tree. They call it the waru tree. It's a hibiscus family tree. And basically, each time they make tempeh, they take a few of the beans out and place maybe a half dozen beans between two leaves of this tree that's right outside their compound, and then overripen it. So when they peel the leaves apart, they're it's a whole mycelial mat, but it's also turned a dark color, the color of sporulation of that particular mold, or it's actually a couple of colors. There's like tan ones that are indicative of Aspergillus molds, along with black ones that are indicative of Rhizopus molds. So they're working with a mixed community that evidently has the ability to perpetuate itself pretty easily. So basically, the way that they made tempeh is, they had dehulled the beans and split them and cooked them, and then laid them out on this big table to dry. And their batch was basically a 50 kilo bag of soybeans. So it's like 100 pounds of dry soybeans that they had dehulled and split and cooked, and they were drying it and cooling it. And once you get rid of most of the surface moisture and you get it down to body temperature, then it's time to introduce the culture. And the way they did that is, this guy took one leaf in each of his hands hands and then just sort of, you know, dug into the soybeans, lifted up a handful and moved his hands against each other, basically to rub these leaves against the surfaces of lots of beans. And then he'd just like pick up another handful and rub them and just try to get different portions of this big pile of soybeans. You know, and then at the end, once he felt they were adequately cultured, before putting it all in, you know, the bags that serve as the forms for the blocks of tempeh, he perpetuated it by taking a few of the beans and putting it between some leaves and doing maybe a half a dozen set of leaves like that to perpetuate it. But I just loved the simplicity of how, you know, in their little, you know, sort of low-tech village operation, they were able to perpetuate it, in contrast to, you know, the extraordinary sterilization methods that are required for perpetuating sort of the single strain that we're mostly working with in the U.S. And to me, it was just, you know, a story of how, you know, sort of the science of microbiology, you know, with its biases against these broad undefined communities of organisms, which are really what all traditional fermentations are based on, you know, in an effort to improve on the cultures, you know, they've actually, you know, disempowered people and made it something that it's impossible for, you know, the casual generalist to propagate.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the KBO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBO website at kbo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Liz Carlisle, Tavia Gilbert, and Sander Katz for being on today's show. I also want to thank WMPG, Southern Maine Community Radio, for letting me use their studios to record the interview with Liz and Tavia. Don't forget to tune in again next month. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel.
Some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly, need some drink.
The preceding program was produced at KBO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
I'm Annie Warmke.
Smiling Annie. And today we're going to talk about eating seasonably, or real tomatoes just don't grow in the snow.
What in the heck does that have to do with that?
It's deep on many levels. Sometime I'm going to figure out what I meant by that. So when we talk about eating seasonably.
Yes.
Eating seasonably.
No, seasonally.
Seasonably.
You keep saying seasonably, but okay. I don't think that's even a word. We'll have to look it up.
I just coined it. So what is it? What is seasonally eating?
Well, seasonally is eating is not new. In fact, except for this culture, this current culture, we have eaten vegetables and fruits when they were in season. I'm sure when you were growing up, you ate root vegetables in the winter and lettuce and tomatoes in the summer, right?
I think we ate Jell-O brand pudding pops, you know, pretty much year round. So.
And marshmallow frozen pie. Oh, that's the worst.
Right. I was the child of suburbia. So we didn't know what seasonally or seasonably meant. So, but we did watch television. So apparently,
good to know.
Yeah, so we knew what farmers did.
I don't know what to say to that.
I saw Green Acres. I know about farming.
Okay. So. I don't know where to go with that.
Okay. So you were talking about eating seasonally. And obviously, seasonal eating has been around since the dawn of time. You got to have some way of preserving food. And there have been some traditional preserving. Otherwise, you're going to eat what comes into season
and
when it's in season.
That's what people did.
And it was how we developed. And obviously, from an evolutionary standpoint, is probably much more healthy.
Well, it is more healthy, and that's one of the many reasons why we should do it. But past generations have done things to preserve foods like ferment them, pickle them, vacuum pack them, which is canning, which you can do with hot water.
Or salting meat,
yeah,
salting.
Drying things.
Fish.
So there were a lot of ways that they could preserve things so that they had foods when the winter months were bad or the summer months were really crazy, too hot kind of thing. And this has been the way we've eaten over time. And then in the last few generations, certainly in starting maybe in the 50s or even the 40s, there was a big push to be modern. So modern meant that we went to the store and we got what we needed and it was prepared for us by other people. And then eventually what's happened is we can eat anything any time of the year as long as it can be shipped. So we eat foods that are shipped, that are grown to be shipped many thousands of miles, and so they lack nutrients, they lack, the food lacks the qualities that we need it to keep us healthy. It looks like it's supposed to, but it's sometimes almost the same as eating air, except that it has calories. So there are also some ancient systems besides the modern world eating seasonally. And one is from the country of India, which is Ayurveda, which perhaps I'm not pronouncing that correctly. But it is one of the world's oldest holistic, which means whole body, healing systems. It's been around between 3,000 to 5,000 years, depending on what you read about it. And it's based on the belief that health and wellness depends on a balance between the mind, the body, and the spirit. And it looks at eating seasonally. It has other components, but to make it sound more simplistic, it talks about eating seasonally. And so why would we want to eat seasonally? And there are several reasons. First of all, the food is fresh. So maybe we grew it ourselves or somebody else grew it for us.
Well, and I'm not exactly a foodie, but I have noticed in my lifetime, like the best corn on the cob I ever ate was when you pick it and then eat it like within minutes of picking it. The best tomatoes, all of these things are really just fresh from the garden.
Yes, you know. They're tastier. But here's the thing that's interesting is that we act like we don't understand what that means. But for people who have grown up in communities where they do raise food, so all of us have grown up in community, well, most of us have grown up in communities where somebody raised vegetables that we ate when it was when they were available according to the right season. So people can hardly wait for fresh tomatoes in the summer or fresh corn on the cob. So they understand that concept, but then they lose that the rest of the year. They just forget that there are things that can be eaten that are locally produced and fresh. So the other thing that you bring up is there's a better taste. The taste is real. The nutrients are in the food for the most part versus the products that are or the produce that's produced in a faraway location.
And isn't some nutritional value of food lost in storage?
Some is lost in storage, but the reality is most of the problem is really in the fact that it's grown to be shipped that
right.
way.
They and so genetically modify it or they do the hybridization or whatever so that it looks like a nice banana when it arrives to you from 4,000 miles away.
Or more.
Even though it tastes like you're essentially chewing on wet styrofoam.
Well, maybe not. Maybe they've got it right. The taste and the look is right. So then you con yourself into thinking this is a good thing, but it's not good for your diet or your body. Also, eating seasonally is good for the earth, for the environment, because it's generally going to be produced locally, and it's cheaper. It's actually cheaper. And it's cheaper from a pocketbook standpoint, but also from the true cost of that. So when you figure out the true cost of something that is grown in the U.S. and then shipped to England to be washed, like an apple, honestly, this happens, and then it's shipped back, this is called globalization, you're not paying the true cost. You're not paying it at all. Somebody's eating that cost. Usually it's the environment, but it's never the corporations.
Well, we keep coming back to the solution of sustainability is almost always going to be localization.
Yes.
Of your activity, of your behavior, of your life, and food at its, I mean, we most of us have access to local food if we take the time to search it out.
Right. And, well, we need education. People need more education about what that means, sure, and why these food, how to use these foods that are available, moving us beyond the normal 10 foods that most, sure, people eat.
But if they're listening to us right now, they're highly educated people.
That's right.
And highly motivated
and
people.
And thinking people.
And they could get off their butt and they can go to a farmer's market. And
or
the
grow
next
their
thing,
own. Or
well,
grow their own.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, I don't know. I'm educated, but I can't do that. And but the other thing is when you buy at a farmer's market, almost all that money goes to the farmer, which is, an
well,
added
more
benefit.
Of it, and it also comes back into the community to support other things that we need locally. Mm-hmm. The other thing to consider that when you're buying foods that are not seasonal or they're coming from far away is that there's a huge pollution toll that we put on the environment. And if you think about you're shipping apples all the way to England or China, and then they're being shipped back. Think of the amazing amount of energy that's being wasted and also the pollution.
Well, that whole concept just is bizarre because that it just reminded me, like, let's say I wanted to wash my clothes and I sent them to India. You know, it's like, okay, I get my clothes dirty. I put them in a thing. I ship them to India. Somebody washes them. They ship them back to me, and then I wear them again. I mean, it seems like there's a better solution.
Well, a better solution in terms of the
everything.
Environment and everything,
everything,
but that solution makes money for corporations.
Uh-huh.
And so if you go to the store and you want to buy an apple that's been treated that way versus an apple that was raised by the apple orchard down the road, you're probably going to, on the face of it, pay a little bit more for that apple that was locally produced. But if you factor in the true cost of the apple that was shipped under the globalization process, nobody would ever buy one apple. It would probably be a year's worth of salary for somebody making minimum wage. But we're not figuring these things out. We're not looking at the true payback to our community by supporting that local orchard versus supporting the globalization and the corporation.
But you're not talking about doing away with the shipping of all crops, because some crops simply cannot be produced where you live. I'm thinking specifically, like, if you live in Michigan, you're not going to have an orange tree in your backyard. And so years ago, oranges were a treat around Christmas time because that's when oranges were being produced down
in
Florida or wherever they happen to be growing. And so they managed to be shipped, but they were shipped when they were ready to be shipped.
Yeah, but we're not getting oranges from Florida most of the time. Citrus is coming from all over the world. So maybe we limit what we have. Mm-hmm. You know, who said we have the right to have everything we want? Nobody. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. So the fact that we want to have citrus, okay, but we could limit ourselves. So we can't have every kind of citrus. We only have certain kinds of citrus because the true cost of that citrus production and shipping is absolutely not affordable by the earth. And you and me. I mean, that's what it really comes down to. So let's move on and let's talk about why else would we want to...
Yeah, let's get out of these downright un-American ideas of not getting everything
you want. No, I don't think
it's
un-American. I think it's very American because it creates opportunity to think through how do we do a better job with this so that our communities are doing better. I think that's very American. So I refuse to buy that argument. So besides the fact that it's cheaper to eat seasonally, it also supports local farmers and communities who choose to farm sustainably. And that is super important because that's the future. So we need to do more of that. And we also need to spread the access that people have. So in poorer communities where they often don't even have a grocery store, we have an opportunity to bring in fresh things and teach people how to use fresh vegetables and herbs and things like that. And they taste better. People are going to want to try.
Well, that just brought up the idea. You're talking about communities that don't have access. I mean, we usually refer to these as food deserts. But it strikes me, if you move to a totally seasonal approach, there is no such thing as a food desert, basically. These deserts exist because the corporations do not find it financially appealing to set up shop, you know, in an inner city or in a rural community. But there's always access to local food production if people take the time and the energy to do it and educate themselves.
Perhaps, but it would bring change. But the reality is most rural communities, people are not really growing food. They're growing big crops.
But we're trying to change their mindset.
That's right.
Their mindset.
But if we do it, if we shifted our thinking, it would bring many changes. We can't even perceive what they would be, but they would be positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you have been listening, or you are listening, sorry, to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. Reminding you, once again, it is the end of the world as we know it.
Thank God.
And we're talking about eating seasonally, the concept that basically food is available, ripens, can be harvested at different times, and surprise, surprise, you can eat them when they're available, and you don't always have to have everything all the time.
That you want.
Yeah, so, you can't always get what you want.
That's right. There's a song, I know it's in there, but don't break into song yet. There is one other issue, and I think this issue is super important, perhaps the most important of all, and that has to do with contamination. We don't really have control over how crops are raised in other countries. And often there is soil contamination and there is no regulation. So when you see at like Walmart, it says organic and it's from China, then you should walk away because that then totally negates the concept of
back
organic.
Back away from the lettuce.
Don't touch it. Because, and another thing is a lot of poor hygiene practices. So if, for example, Australians have had some problems with infections being transmitted on crops that have been exported. Also, an example would be garlic. So it is radiated or irradiated, bleached and sprayed with methyl bromide to withstand quarantine and long periods of travel. And they also do this with many fruits and vegetables.
Sounds tasty.
Yeah, well, you're not going to taste it, but your body's going to experience it, and then it's going to stay in your gut. So that garlic is produced everywhere in this country, everywhere. People can grow it themselves. Lots of people grow it, and you can buy it locally, and it is not irradiated, bleached, or sprayed with methyl bromide. So we need to be doing that. So let's move on to some of the things that if we look at summer, fall, winter, and spring, some examples of things that we would eat. And
okay,
then,
so walk us through the year.
Yes,
all
I
right.
Shall.
It's the beginning of the year, right?
Yes.
January. What are we going to eat if we're eating seasonally?
Okay, in January, we're going to aim to eat more things that are sweet, sour, and salty because we want heavier foods, meats, things like that.
So Snickers bar dipped in lemonade. Sweet, okay. Sour, and salty.
I have no comment. So we're going to eat things like beets. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong. Well, yes, we can eat beets because we can store beets. We can store beets in sand. We can cook beets and store them in vinegar. So we have the ability to keep those root crops, some of those root crops, over the winter season.
I know sometimes you're saying store them in sand, like a bucket of sand. You just put these things in?
So they
in,
don't touch. Yeah.
Touch each other. Do people use sawdust and stuff like that,
they
too?
They could. Sand might be better for beets so they don't dry out so much. You might dampen it slightly. People used to do it all the time. They would have what they called spring houses, and they would have these big wooden bins that had slats so there was air that could circulate a little bit, and they might have sawdust or sand, and they would bury cabbage and other root crops, potatoes. You don't really have to store potatoes that way. It just needs to be a little bit dry for potatoes. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so they had ways of storing these things so that they had them all through the winter into the spring, and then some of those things would become their seed for the next year's crop. So back to winter. So we want to eat some things like mushrooms. I know you love those.
Mm.
Potatoes, sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are really nutritious, tasty, versatile vegetable. Brassicas, which are cabbage, Brussels sprouts, another one of your favorites. And broccoli, cauliflower. So these things can also be pickled. Cabbage can be, the way to preserve that is just to preserve it as a head, like in sand or sawdust. But we can preserve brassicas by pickling them. We can do what they call, I can't think of the term anyway, so you boil water.
Blanch it.
Blanch, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And which is just to dip them quickly in the water, the boiling water, and then you cool them quickly, and then you can freeze them, and that locks in the flavor.
Okay, well, so far I'm not really enjoying the winter months of brassicas and mushrooms, but what about spring?
Apples,
I can handle.
So we can have lots of apples over the winter, and they can be stored just easily in a box. And or we can dry them, cut them up and dry them in the fall. We can also can them. We can fry apples and can them. We can make applesauce. We can make apple butter by cooking down the apples. So we have a lot of ways to preserve things for over the winter.
And I am always surprised at the apples, because we get a lot of apples in the fall when they're harvested. And they do last quite easily all the way through winter.
I used the last ones in March.
Yeah.
The ones that we brought in at the end of October. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So winter is a rich time for food, even though we may not think of it that way. We can also grow greens, if we're really careful, by covering them with a hoop. We can also grow them under a grow light, so we can just cut a leaf here and there. So there are lots of ways to have food in the winter that we don't have to purchase at the store. Some other things in winter are onions, another one of your favorites, pumpkin, so different kinds of squash that are easily stored in a cool place if you have a basement storage area, leeks, radishes, greens like mustard and collards, which I know another one of your favorites, turnips, and then citrus fruits. Those are a winter fruit because they come in to season in starting in December, late December, all the way through March, different kinds of citrus from this country, not from somewhere else. So then we come into spring, which is a rich time, not just for cultivated foods, but also wild foods. So those foods for spring, we're looking for things that are more astringent, bitter, and pungent foods, because those foods are going to help us to clean out our systems, and we need to do that for so we can be healthier for the summer and all the hard work.
A little bit of spring cleaning going on.
That's right. We want that. And that can come from wild food. So we can take things like different plants from the wild, stinging nettle for one. The young stinging nettle leaves we can collect up, and we can make a really delicious soup from that, or we can put it in vodka and make a tincture that we can put drops of in food or something that we want, not to season it, but just to have that in our system to help us to make our blood stronger and healthier. So asparagus, beets again, we can cultivate beets really early, maybe sow seed even in late February for beets. And the spring onions, there's also a lot of wild onions and wild garlic. Greens, lots of wild greens, wild lettuce, pokeweed, all kinds of really great healthy greens that are out there. Some kinds of peppers and turnips, and the favorite of almost anybody. I never met anybody who didn't really love strawberries. So those are spring foods. And there are wild strawberries. And then right now, as we come really into the heart of summer, we're looking at things like elderberry. The flowers right now, they're highly edible, and you can make syrup with them for the winter. And it's full of all kinds of vitamins that are good as a tonic for the winter. So there's all kinds of wild foods as well. And then we come into summer, which is the richest time of all, and that's the busiest time. And summer's a time for light foods and cooling foods, and also many wonderful herbs. Again, beets. Beets are really anytime.
Eating seasonally. Just eat beets all year long.
Well, pickle.
Right?
I'm surprised at how many people like pickled beets. They might not eat them.
I actually like pickled beets.
Yeah, so this is shocking because it's a food that has color and you like it. Mm-hmm. So, but then blueberries. You like blueberries.
Oh,
strawberries.
The best.
So chard, that's a delicious green that you can also grow other seasons. Chili peppers, gooseberries, green beans, mint, nectarines. These are all wonderful things that are available everywhere, some more expensive than others. But you can do things like you can buy peaches by the box. And yes, they seem expensive, but if you cut them up and put them in the freezer, or maybe you make jam or some kind of jelly with them. You can peaches, so delicious in the wintertime especially. Also, other things available in the summer are melons, which also can be cut up and frozen, quite delicious in smoothies in the wintertime or the spring. Cherries, tomatoes, artichokes, beans, berries, peppers, nectarines, cucumbers, zucchini, eggplant, and on and on and on.
Well, you mentioned the expense aspect, and I guess that's something that always surprises me because it seems like fresh fruits and fresh foods are pretty expensive if you buy them in the grocery store, relatively so. And I guess you're giving me the look like, how dare you call this expensive? It's all that other stuff.
No, no, no. The grocery store is expensive. So, example, if you wanted to have peaches in the winter or cherries or blueberries, and you said, all right, I'm just going to put them in little Ziploc bags and I'm going to freeze them. And then you go to the store any time of the year and you see what that same amount, that same weight of that package would be in the store. You're going to see that whatever you invested in that box of peaches or those quarts of blueberries is cheap compared to what it would cost to buy. They're in little bags and they're like $6 and $7. Or maybe even more for little bags of blueberries or frozen peaches. So you may have an upfront experience, but if you average that out.
You mean expense?
Oh, say experience. Well, that's true. Experience too. But an expense.
Experiencing this expense.
Yes. You're going to see that if you draw that out over the year, it's a very cheap food. But then let me say that one of the things that happens in spring and summer and fall is that every day, at least on our farm, we are preparing for the other 365 days of the year. So right now we're making elderberry syrup, we're freezing strawberries, we're going to start freezing blueberries.
But isn't that kind of contrary to the whole seasonal eating? Because we're preparing to store these things for the seasons when they're no longer available.
Well, that would be one of the options so that we have things that we want to eat, but we're doing it when it benefits the farmer, benefits locally, and maybe we don't have an option to do that, but we have a guide. We need to have some kind of guide that says these are the foods that we should be eating right now because, first of all, our bodies are happier eating this way.
Right, they're craving them.
Yeah, we require heavier foods in the winter to stay warm and lighter foods in the summer to be cool. So let's get to fall. So fall foods are plentiful and amazing.
Well, that's harvest time, right?
Well, summer's a lot of it starts in the summer. But fall foods are really warming foods. So we're starting to want to feel warmer from the foods we eat. And they tend to be sweeter, also a little bit bitter and astringent. And the herbs are plentiful also. So there's a lot of berries and a lot of wild things like leghorn sumac, which is high in vitamin C that we collect up and we make a drink with that. And then we dry it and we take the berries and we use them for infusing oil for dipping bread for a meal. And then we dry some of the pods for decoration. So fall, in terms of things that people can readily find, is broccoli, carrots, cabbage, cauliflower, greens, beans, pears, plums, pumpkins, apples. So lots of
I was listening for beets. I didn't hear beets in there.
Beets are there, but I didn't read them because I knew you were going to tease me.
Come on, give me some beets. So,
and a lot of these foods can be preserved for the rest of the year if you have access to a freezer or if you have the ability to can some food. And there's tons of videos online that show you how to can, or you can ask somebody who already does canning. Every year we have people asking to come can with me, and it's fun. It's more fun to can with others. It's a long day, but lots of good stories are told as we prepare food and get it in jars and can that stuff. And it's a rich life. So let me just say a couple
things. Well, I was just going to point out, as you're going to say that if you are shopping seasonally, it seems like when these things are abundant, they would be less expensive.
Yeah, and that's when you want to be prepared, have a plan to use them. Mm-hmm. So an example of a winter recipe that might be super good, it's basically a bean and potato recipe, but that we're going to use things like coconut oil and cumin seeds. These are warm ingredients. We're going to have different colors of potatoes and different kinds of turmeric and oregano and basil and black beans and some collard leaves. And we're going to cook all that up and add some garlic. And we're going to say that is delicious. And we're going to feel warm when we eat it.
Mm-hmm. It's sounding a bit like the Splendid Table show here. Where
hardly.
You're giving all of these recipes. Well, anyway, we'll close with that. And just to remind you, you have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our award-winning producer, Adam Rich, and we want to thank you for just spending just a couple of moments with us. And as your grandmother told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and she made wonderful cakes. Eat your cake.
Eat your cake.
Yes.
And have it too.
Yes.
Till next time.
Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be...
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.